Welcome to the Rethink ELA podcast, hosted by English language arts teacher Michelle Waters. Prepare to receive strategies, products, and expert advice tailored to help teachers build social awareness, student agency, and voice in their ELA classrooms.
Welcome to the Rethink ELA podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Waters. As the kids would say, it's been a minute since I recorded an episode. Since then, I've graduated from the University of Oklahoma with a master's degree in instructional leadership and academic curriculum, and I've been accepted into the PhD program for the same department. I'm now taking 9 hours of classes, so things are a little wild around here. I've also stepped out of the classroom to focus on running this business, which gives me more time to collaborate with teachers like my guest today, Dani Nagel, who is head of the English department at Moore High School. She teaches American literature, which is junior English around here, and serves on the board of the Oklahoma Council of Teachers of English. We've taken classes together, spent some time studying together, and I am so excited to discuss options for teachers who are required to teach the canon. We'll hear from her in a few minutes.
Encourage your high school students to share their stories, discuss building a representative society, and develop their writing skills. With this set of 15 highly engaging lesson plans, you can mix and match to meet your students' needs. Download this unit at rethinkela.com/sjwp.
Welcome back to the Rethink ELA podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Waters, and I am here today with my friend and colleague, Dani Nagel O'Rourke. We've had some OU classes together, and that's University of Oklahoma. And I'm really excited to have the conversation that we are about to have. Welcome.
Hey, I'm happy to be here.
I'm glad to hear that. We've had some interesting things going on in our state that I think are mirroring some political things that are happening in other states as well, specifically centered around what teachers can teach. Dani, can you tell me a little more about what you have heard and kind of how that looks or how that has impacted your class?
So I think that the biggest thing is just that we have a certain climate in Oklahoma education, really, where there are certain ideas that are being complicated, right, by our legislation specifically. So whenever we're looking at in the classroom, we're dealing with the offset of that, where we are trying to kind of fight back against certain institutions within our educational system that don't serve students. Right. Yeah. And one of those things, I think, is the canon. We've kind of addressed that within some of our college courses. You know, we talked about that, I think, in quite a few of the courses that we've gone through, just that, you know, how much do these texts that were written centuries ago, even decades ago, in some instances, not really represent our student populations. And so I think that's kind of the big thing that we were wanting to talk about today.
Absolutely. I know that I have had a couple of other episodes on the podcast and some blog posts about disrupting the canon and kind of recognizing that it's mainly written by dead white men and trying to get some other voices in there. Can you tell us more about what exactly the canon is and what it represents?
Yeah, I teach specifically high school English. And so whenever I think of the canon as a department chair, it's based on the course, right? Whenever we're talking about American literature, we're talking about what are the texts that people say represent American identity and society within that realm, right? British literature, who are the voices that speak to British history and British society and culture? World literature, same thing, but whose voices are represented there? That's the canon. So those are the ones that we call the great, we define great literature as. And so whenever we're looking at that and complicating that, we're just questioning really whose voices are present within the canon.
Why is this so controversial right now?
I would say the big thing is just like what you just touched on, is that it's mostly dead white men. And that's not indicative of our history as a country. It's not indicative of our global populations. And so whenever you're talking about why it's controversial, it's because not all voices are present in the canon. We could argue all day about whether that's intentional, but it's also just because of systems of power over time, right? The dominant culture is who had access, number one, to the resources, potentially to the wealth, and also to the power structure that perpetuated those voices being given a space to exist, right? So that's the controversy, is that now we are coming into a space after many civil rights movements and equality movements, right, to talk about the fact that, you know, where are these voices? They've existed, just not on a page. So why aren't we giving them any airtime in a classroom? I think that's kind of the big controversy that we're seeing, is the lack of diversity of perspectives that represents the diversity of our populations in the world.
Absolutely. And I think that's where we go back to what Dr. Dean Sims Bishop said in terms of windows, mirrors, and sliding glass doors. Can you talk to us a little bit about what she was referencing?
Yeah, so I think that goes back to that representation, right, of books serve different purposes for students. Whenever Bishop was talking about that, there were a couple different things. And I think there's a couple other researchers that are also pulled into that. But mirrors serve as a reflection of a student's identity. Windows serve as a kind of way to view others' perspectives or viewpoints or realities who maybe don't have the same identity structure or intersectionality as you. And then a sliding glass door actually allows you to kind of experience different perspectives, different worldviews, maybe complexities in identity, kind of firsthand through those experiences. So,
yeah, so like being able to step into a world that you would never be able to go to in any other way.
The whole walk a mile in somebody else's shoes thing, right?
I know in my own class, I try to look at the students that I have in there and see, you know, who has all the mirrors and who doesn't have very many windows, and then try to, well, like you say, complicate that, you know, switch things up. So if I have kids who have tons of mirrors, and, you know, studies have shown that the majority of the children and young adult literature features white characters. So those students, I try to give them more windows or give them access to more windows that they can choose. And then students that have fewer mirrors find those mirrors for them so that they can read them. And I, you know, I've had at least a few cases actually where I've handed a kid a book that I thought would be a mirror for that kid, and they handed it back and said, "Hey, Miss Waters, you need to read this book." And I realized it was actually a better window for me, or even a sliding glass door.
And I think that that's the thing too, is thinking about positive and negative representations, right? Where sometimes we have a lot of token characters that we say serve as a mirror or a window, right? But they can also perpetuate stereotypes. So we have to kind of be critical in what we say we're replacing the canon with. And I think that's also kind of a different conversation, honestly. But
and so you just mentioned replacing the canon, but I know that in some places already, and maybe in the future in some other places, replacing the canon may not be an option. Districts or legislatures may say you have to teach these books. So what does that mean?
I think that the big thing is whenever we're saying complicate the canon, we're not necessarily replacing it, right? Because the reality is, resource-wise, the state of Oklahoma education, we don't have access to licenses for books and things like that. So what do we have in our curriculum closet? We have the canon. We have the classics, right? Yeah. And so if that's what we have to work with, we can use that. But really kind of turn that over in our hand with students and ask, like, does this actually represent us, right? Are there better books that can do that? And ask them to really do the thinking there on whether they feel represented by those books with their own identity pieces.
So we talked about complicating it. What does that look like? So let's say that you know, have gone to the resource closet, you've found a class set of books that you are going to teach in your American literature class. How does that look maybe on a day-to-day basis?
I think there's maybe a couple of ways that you can do that. And number one is by contrast, right? So putting multiple classics side by side, or putting some contemporary lit next to the canon, right, to provide multiple perspectives. So that duplicity and multiplicity of voices that we're saying is missing, we can kind of look at what's there and what's not. We talk about the extent of the curriculum that is obvious to us, but then also what is hidden. So whenever we're putting a classic in front of a student and kind of asking them, like, whose identity is represented here, but also whose is missing, and then we provide another text that maybe fills that opposite void of a voice, it kind of provides an opportunity to complicate that canon. And then conversely, it's just critiquing the canon, which is maybe providing them one example or multiple. I always like multiplicity, where they can kind of sit down and look at, you know, again, we say that this is great literature. Maybe it was 100 years ago, does it still hold that same relevance to our society, our problems now, our populations, and our lived experience? So I think that that's kind of the two things that you can do is contrast it either with other classics or with more contemporary literature, or really just critique the classic that you're looking at, the one that's in question.
Can you give us a specific example of how this has looked or what you have done in your classroom?
Yeah. So whenever we talk about like contrast, right? There are a lot of things where I think that film is honestly unappreciated, where you can use a, you know, a canon text, right? And you can read that in its entirety. But as long as you're not reading that and telling students that this is the holy Bible of text, you know, you need to know this to be well-read and to be educated. If you're pulling in other sources like short stories, poetry, articles, things like that, you're able to really kind of point out the complexity, right, of a text and what it does or does not show about what it says it does. And really, each book is a snapshot of a certain aspect of the person who wrote it. And again, whenever we have certain voices missing, that's kind of where that can produce issues. I would say that like in my own classroom, it's really just pulling in multiple texts next to the canon, or literature circles is really the big way that I have done that, as well as independent reading is kind of a subversive space to approach texts perpendicular to the classics.
I know that I have done that as well with the literature circles. A few years ago, I gave students the choice to choose between The Hate U Give, All American Boys, Dreamland Burning, and Tulsa Burning. And, you know, I didn't have any of those resources available at my school, so I had to plan this ahead of time. I had students sign up for the book that they wanted to read, and then I ordered them through Donors Choose. And when the books came in, then, you know, I handed them out and we were able to start doing our reading project or our literature circle project. And I did have a few students who were like, okay, I don't like this book. And so we were able to do some switching around a little bit. And I did have one student who didn't like any of the books. She ended up reading The Poet X and loved it. So we kind of just brought another book in. But we had already, you know, read, I think it was The Great Gatsby, and we'd read a couple of some poems and things from the canon. And then this was just kind of a way to listen to some different voices. And it gave students an opportunity to step into some worlds that they would not in any other way have the opportunity to do so. How has that looked in your classroom?
Yeah, like very similar. I think that whenever I've done like, I haven't done a ton of literature circles because I think that's really a more recent idea that's come about. And like I said, resources are a huge thing. But last year we had the opportunity to kind of invest in some literature circle novels and class sets of things for our department. And so we got our hands on like Educated by Tara Westover, Americana by Chimamanda Adichie, The Roundhouse by Louise Erdrich, and All American Boys by Brendan Keeley and Jason Reynolds. Books like that that really kind of provide a multiplicity. And they're more relevant and contemporary, right? They're things that are high interest to kids that they actually want to pull from a shelf and look at. If I hand a kid Moby Dick, I don't know if that's really going to happen. Definitely just those books that honestly they're hearing about. There's like TikTok groups and everything that the kids tell me about. Like I saw this and part of this group and I see these books. They don't really see the classics in those spaces, right? That's not what they're excited to read. Some of them are, but for the most part, they really do have other interests. And those are the voices that we're saying are missing anyway. So we may as well just pull those into our classrooms.
And I love the fact, too, that you can pull in author interviews, you know, watch, you know, find on YouTube where the author has talked about reading and writing and what message that they were trying to convey and, you know, what it has meant to them as a person and what the book means to them as a writer. And so kids can see a living, breathing person and hear what they have to say about, you know, the writing and reading. Reading experiences and, you know, just their lived experiences as well and what it means to be an American or to be, you know, a global citizen, depending, you know, whatever class that you're teaching.
Yeah.
And then there's been at least one time when I've been able to put something like on Twitter and the author responded and like, hey.
Well, and that really creates that excitement. And a lot of our job is really just trying to inspire a joy and a love of reading. Because if we can get that going, then that will hopefully continue through their lives, right? So I think that that excitement of, you know, meeting authors and knowing their work and knowing why they did what they did. We have that age old joke of like English teachers who say what the meaning is, but then like they've been dead for 200 years. So we really have no clue. So it's just kind of one of those things that it really is relevant. It's present. It's exciting for the kids. And so anytime you can fill in like contemporary work, it can be difficult just because, like you said, like where does that money come from? A lot of times from teachers' pockets or from donors' choose projects or donations, and that's not always really possible.
Something that I'm trying to figure out as part of my research, I started my PhD program, and I, you know, in talking to people like you and Jennifer Williams and Claudia Swisher, you know, I know that literature and getting books in front of kids that, you know, are the windows and the mirrors and the sliding glass doors and that the kids want to read is an important piece of, you know, getting them to understand that reading and writing is important to them, not only in some distant future and for some distant job, but right now. So literature is important. And then, of course, you know, there's the writing piece, which, you know, well, we can talk about that one later. And language, which I'm just kind of opening my mind to right now. But basically, in order to get kids to want to be literate in terms of, I mean, kids, they already can read and write, they just don't want to. And they've sat right there and looked me in the eye and said, Ms. Waters, I can read and write and I do just fine on the state test, but I don't want to. I don't see the point in it.
Yeah,
and I feel like we have lost as educators and as an education system when kids sit there and tell you that. So we have to find a way to make it relevant to them. And I think that either bringing in literature that feature voices that they are interested in and that they need to hear, or at least giving them the opportunity or opening up the opportunity to question what they are reading. So, you know, I'm not indoctrinating kids. I'm giving them opportunities to ask questions.
Well, and I think too that whenever we're talking about Bishop's research into mirrors, windows, and sliding glass doors, like that language should be used in classrooms. Kids need to know what they're looking for in a book, because on one day I may hand one of my Indigenous students a book that is a mirror, but maybe that's not what they're looking for that day, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think that them knowing that, like, obviously we talk about like the classics, they almost have a different purpose, right? They're meant to be chewed on. They're meant to kind of be thought about in terms of time and space. But whenever we're talking about like YA Lit, it really is like those three things, right? It reflects who they are. It reflects the experience of another, or it allows them to walk a mile in somebody else's shoes. And on a different day, I want different things from a book, you know?
Yep.
So I think using that language is really powerful too in helping students start to think about what they need.
And I think it's kind of falls in line with helping students discover who they are as readers and what they need as readers, like you just touched on. It's not about just saying, oh, you know, I really loved, you know, Jane Eyre when I was growing up, so I'm going to teach that book. It's about who are these kids in front of me.
Yeah. And I, again, like you and I could go all day about independent reading, couldn't we? That might need to be a separate podcast. But on this one, I definitely think that like when you're teaching the canon and honoring your students, and that's what's in front of you, it's kind of thinking through, like, number one, do these texts represent our students? And if they don't, then we need to be honest with that, you know? We can't try to present that as, hey, guys, you know, these are the texts that really show who we are as a society. This is our history. It is, right? But we don't, it's not necessarily our proudest history in some instances. Right. So we need to be, you know, transparent with students about that. And I'm of the mindset, you know, that skills-based learning is always going to be more important than content-based learning. And I think that's the problem with the canon in a lot of instances, is teachers see this as a fund of knowledge that students have to take into society with them. And that's not true. I mean, I haven't read The Outsiders, The Giver, Fahrenheit 451. I didn't read any of those because I went to school in Texas. Yeah. That wasn't part of our reading list. And so even district to district, state to state, we don't have the same idea of what the canon is. So is it really, you know, this list of texts and fund of knowledge that students need to be a good citizen?
On that topic, I was taking a literature class as part of my master's degree, and we had students in that class who were, they were working on their master's, and we also had some higher level undergrad students. There were probably about 20 English teachers in the room, and none of us had read every one of the top 10 books most taught in high school.
Yeah,
none of us had read that entire list.
And I think that is an idea that we kind of come to, is we need everybody to have the same understanding of what is good literature, right? Right. But none of us agree. So it's just kind of a funny misconception we have in our field that some of us, the old dogs, but also some of us, the younger generation, have bought into entirely too. So it's just trying to break that behavior, you know, it doesn't benefit students.
So what advice would you give to a teacher who's kind of new to the idea of complicating the canon? What would you tell them in terms of how to get started doing that?
I think it's just kind of analyzing your own history with the canon, number one, kind of reflecting on your own behavior and thoughts and beliefs in terms of what that represents for yourself, but then also thinking about your student population and really placing that next to them and saying, does this show them, you know, that they have a place in our history, that they have a voice in who we are and were and how we got here? And if the answer is no, then that's where you start to think about how to contrast those spaces, how to critique those spaces with students. And again, I think literature circles are a super underevaluated or underutilized tool in tackling the canon. They provide diverse perspectives, multiplicity of lives and viewpoints. They allow for contrast. And I think that comparative analysis that students do, that's the real beauty, is because you're leaving the power in students' hands to answer that question, right? Yeah. Of do these texts represent them? And if not, what does that maybe show? And how do we combat that?
And I think it's important to give students the opportunity to come up with their own questions as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Anything student generated surrounding like literature circles in the canon is going to be powerful because they see this, you know, they're like, why do we have to read these texts? And that's a legitimate question, you know, not just because we have to or because you need to know this is not a legitimate answer. And we need to start pushing back against that, you know, when they are very in tune with their own needs and we can't continue to, you know, undermine their power and ability to define those needs and what they see is necessary in the world. So I definitely think that defining what the canon is, as well as what good literature is really a good question to put in student hands, because they'll tell you.
And I think that's especially important too, putting the questions into students' hands, you know, having them generate questions and facilitating that process of generating the questions and analyzing potential answers, you know, based on what they're reading in the literature. Because, you know, at some point in time, in some cases and in some contexts, you might end up having some community pushback, either from your administration, you know, or parents who don't want their kid to read about police brutality, for example. And so one of the best, not really defenses against that, but responses to that would be, you know, the student chose this book and the student chose, you know, those questions and the students were having this conversation and, you know, I was facilitating it to make sure everyone was respecting each other and they did. And, you know, what can they say at that point?
And I also think that a lot of literature circles are on a really small scale because we are trying to use a lot of contemporary literature, but I did 16 different canon novels for my kids. And that was really what we did, was we investigated the canon and we looked at it. And that space in between books, right, where students are doing the work contrasting their books against other students' books, it wasn't me, right, standing up at the front saying, now let's compare The Great Gatsby to Catch 22. No, the kids are the ones in Socratic seminars really discussing, like, well, my book really shows this about what it means to be an American. Well, see, mine directly contrasts what yours says. And here's how, and here's examples of that. And so we really get into this question of who do these books represent? Which aspects of being an American are represented? And does that actually, you know, fit your ideas, students, of what it means to be an American? And so when you're thinking through, like, if you put those questions in their hands, they're going to do all the work. It's just about scaffolding that learning and making it happen, but they're happy to take it on.
So what other advice, or do you have anything else to add to help teachers who are wanting to work within a complicated context, but give students the opportunity to ask questions and think critically?
I think that the first thing is really just kind of letting go of preconceived notions of what has to come of an exploration of the canon and contemporary lit and things like that. I think our preconceived notions as teachers tend to guide the way that we design our curriculum. And that can be really problematic because it eliminates that student-centered learning that you just talked about, right? the discussion pieces, their questioning, and the natural flow that comes from that, because that's the reality, is they're going to guide a lot of the learning whenever that happens, but that also protects you. So that's a really important advice piece I would give you as a department chair, number one, but also as a teacher, is just that obviously if you're putting everything back on the students, it's authentic. And it's autonomous for them. So that takes the power out of your hands and puts it in theirs. That protects you as a teacher. And that protects the students too, because a parent can come and say, I don't want my kid learning about this. But guess what? Whenever they're in a population of 30 kids in a classroom, that is one perspective. And that's what this unit does, is it talks about the duplicity of what it means to be an American, or what the canon represents about our society. Is that there isn't just one perspective on these issues. Yeah. And that's something important for students to learn. And a lot of them will speak to that to their parents about the fact that, you know, like I learned a lot. I didn't agree with everything, but that's okay because I got to see other people's mindsets, perspectives, viewpoints, and experiences. So I think that's kind of the big takeaway that I could give based on my experience.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you speaking with us, and I'm looking forward to chatting with you again.
Yeah, I am as well. Thank you for your time, Michelle, today. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about something I really like.
Same here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Rethink ELA Podcast. I'm Michelle Waters, and I can't wait to give you a few resources I've developed to help you create a student-centered, collaborative, and creative learning environment. Download these resources when you join our mailing list at rethinkela.com/news.